things get a little bit grim.
But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
I don't know how old I am! Okay?
Please allow me to continue thinking that I'm 18 years old.
Please.
I think you go first on this one.
Oh, do I? Okay. I just need to fire up my good old iPad here.
Dang old doobadops.
How are you?
No. Put it in the blooper reel.
Oh my god.
I'm good.
Jesus. Scooter. I'm Gucci.
Gucci. Gucci, Gucci, Louis, Louis, Fendi, Fendi, Prada.
Wow, that was a lot.
Of designer bags?
Of designer bags in one sentence.
Do we not remember Krayshawn from 2007?
What?
Oh.
We don't.
No, I don't.
Just me then.
Yeah. That's fine. That's probably for the best, honestly.
What is this?
Hi, she's a singer. Her name is Krayshawn. I wouldn't... singer is playing it fast and loose.
Okay.
Think... Do you remember, like, 2010 Kesha?
Yes.
2010 Kesha.
Oh, okay. I love 2010 Kesha.
You would probably like this one particular song by Krayshawn.
Okay.
I'm sure I made you listen to it.
Probably.
When we were in college.
Hey, I remember fondly... A few winter times ago, we were driving to the arena.
Oh, my God.
And we were blasting really, really deep and gritty rap music.
I love that for us.
When we were at our friend's bachelorette party.
Oh, that was not that long ago.
That wasn't that long ago.
Yikes.
And I was like, I don't know any of the lyrics to these songs, but they are talking about drugs.
Drugs.
The drugs. You're over there like just like going hard at it. I'm like, I don't know what's happening. And then we have our friend Hope in the backseat.
Listen, Hope was having a grand old time.
She was having the best time. Oh my god.
I love that. There is a very small part of me that I'll even do it like as I'm driving away from the elementary school after I'm dropping my stepson off and I'm playing like Bad Baby.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a community school. It's fitting.
I have a whole playlist for when I'm feeling a little edgy. This is embarrassing. I can't believe I'm talking about this.
Put it out on the podcast. Let me hear all about it.
There's a song called You and Jennifer. That it's like, I hope you had a good time with her. Fuck you and Jennifer. Like, I don't know how I found this song, but it's jam. I like it.
I love that.
I'll play it for you later. It's an interesting song.
That is a very polar opposite. I just made a playlist on my Spotify that is titled Oat Milk Lattes and Sunrise in the Appalachian Mountains.
I am here for that.
I have reorganized all of my music aesthetically.
Thanks, TikTok.
Thank you for that. And it's honestly working really well for me.
Is it?
Yeah.
What's on this playlist?
Oh, we got a little bit of the Avett Brothers. We've got some Laura Marling.
Oh, yeah.
We've got Mandolin Orange. Mumford and Sons.
Okay.
Very banjo heavy.
Yeah.
There might be a kazoo. Exactly what you would think.
Have you listened to... I know you listened to Taylor Swift's Folklore, but have you listened to Evermore?
I have not.
Okay. So I just need you to listen to two songs.
Okay.
Three. There is one called Champagne Problems.
Ooh. Relate.
Excellent. There is one called Tis the Damn Season.
Is it a Christmas song?
Kinda.
Okay.
It is about... this, like, going back to her hometown, and there's the boy that lives there, and she's like, tis the damn season, I'm staying at my parents' house, the road less traveled by, like, basically, come over. And then there is...
Stop hooking up with the boys I used to hook up with in high school. Can I just put that out? Listen, we have grown. I understand the, like, reduce, reuse, recycle to keep the body count.
Keep the body count down.
Wherever you think you need the body mm-hmm. count to be.
Yeah.
Stop hooking up with people that you hooked up with in high school. If they haven't left the hometown... They
leave them behind.
They have not grown at all.
It will make you feel things about your eighth grade year.
I very specifically blocked that trauma out of my brain. And my therapy path is not that far along yet for me to be reopening that box.
Oh God, I haven't even gotten there with my therapist.
Yeah, No.
Oh, Lord. But I would recommend the song. It's very good. And then there is Nobody, No Cry.
Huh?
Taylor Swift gives us a true crime song.
Name the episode that, future Taylor.
Okay, I will.
Nobody, No Cry.
Yeah. So, would recommend. And she is a whole aesthetic. I think we're getting another...
side.
And we're going to get another album. She's going to give us three that are this aesthetic. Down to earth, not a lot of frills.
I love it.
I do too. I'm so freaking here for it.
It's such a different aesthetic. I feel like Miley Cyrus is feeding us a different aesthetic too.
Oh, I love Miley.
I do too.
Oh my gosh. Her Jolene is probably one of my favorites.
Ooh, it's a, yeah.
It's so good.
I love when we stop trying to force, like, 20-something female pop artists into the pop box.
Yes.
Let them be. Lady Gaga did it with her Jolene album.
Yep.
And I fucking love that album.
Yeah. Like, I love to watch artists spread their wings a little bit and mm-hmm. embrace a side of themselves that they want to be.
Yep.
I think Panic did that. Yeah. And their most recent album is different than their other albums. Yep. Like, I love all of their stuff, but I love... their most recent.
I don't know. Truth and Never Sweat Out just has, like, has its claws. It reminds me of that dude from my hometown that I used to hook up with. But, like, in a really terrible way.
Like, a little bit toxic.
A little bit toxic. I mean, just, like, straight up toxicity. Yeah.
Put a poison label on it and call it a day.
Good God. I want to have a pep talk with 16-year-old me and be like, sis...
shape up.
Ooh, let's get it together.
And I wish I could have the same pep talk with Taylor, with 16-year-old Taylor. That's like, girl, you gotta loosen up.
Let go.
Quit acting like this.
There was a reason.
You're a crazy person.
The universe brought us together.
We like immediately neutral chaos each other.
Honestly, and like there are times now where you are more loosey-goosey than I am.
I know. It's a weird time.
It is a weird time.
That's all right. We're going to do this together.
Speaking of weird people who come together for weird times.
Look at this. We're talking about cults today.
Oh, I love it. Back to like a place where I feel very at home.
My cult is... That's all I got to say.
My cult is also...
I will tell you, mine escalates quick. Like, it escalates, like... I'm so sorry that I don't have very much middle here.
Okay. We're going from, like, nothing to everything.
Yeah, it gets like... It's like, oh, okay, history. Kind of weird. Like, kind of uncomfy, but, like, nothing tragically, like... wrong and then really bad.
Oh, so we don't like, get like a bunch of red flags before we get to...
We get a couple, but it's like, I'll just tell you about it. How's
that? You go first. So just let's just dive on. Quit the summarizing. Just tell me the story.
Right. Okay. So this is the story of the Valley of the Islamic Dolls.
Okay.
And it's going to make you very uncomfortable.
Okay. I love when things do that to me.
I know you do. It's going to make you sweaty. Okay. Adnan Oktar was born February 2nd, 1956, and he was raised in Ankara, Turkey.
Mm.
In 1979, Oktar went to Istanbul and went to Mimar Sinan Fine Arts University, where he studied interior architecture.
Love that.
There was a lot of unrest during this time. An article in the New Humanist magazine describes the political climate like this. The environment in Turkey was one of political and cultural instability, threatened by Cold War politics and a clash between Kemalist secular modernizers and a rising tide of Islamic militancy.
Okay.
A lot of words that are all bad.
I heard a lot of buzzwords in there, but yeah. My brain couldn't really compute.
That's okay. All we need to do is the buzzwords.
Okay.
From 1982 to 1984, he preached his views of Islam to a group of about 20 to 30 people. Most of these people were from high-class economic backgrounds. And he wanted to surround himself with young people with wealthy, well-connected families. Think Horace Slughorn.
Ah, uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah?
Yep. I needed that reference. Thank you.
You got it. Oktar's teachings argued against Marxism, communism, and materialistic philosophy.
Boo. Just kidding.
It's going to get weird because we get very materialistic here.
Oh, okay.
He was specifically very against the idea of evolution and Darwinism. So he's a huge advocate for creationism.
Okay.
The BBC.
If we must.
We must.
Okay.
This is like one of the biggest pillars that he will die on.
Oh.
The BBC points out that he had a huge issue with Britain and created an entire website dedicated to criticizing the BBC.
Oh. I love that the BBC reported on their own criticism.
Oh, absolutely. It was like italicized in the article I read.
I fucking love the BBC so
much. I do too. He enrolled in the philosophy department of Istanbul University in 1986. Around this time, he appeared on the cover of Nakota magazine and began to appear more regularly in the press.
Wow.
He also published a 550-page book called Judaism and Freemasonry, which is an anti-Semitic rhetoric.
What?
It's all over the place.
Okay.
He was arrested for promoting the theocratic revolution. He was never formally charged, but he was detained for 19 months. He also spent 10 months in a mental hospital, although he claims he was not and is not mentally ill, but was a political prisoner who was being punished for publishing his book.
Meh.
During this time, he's still gaining followers and building his community. In 1990, Oktar founded the Science Research Foundation, which is interesting for somebody who refutes the idea of evolution.
Yeah.
So this was mostly so that he could hold conferences and seminars and promote his anti-evolution rhetoric. Between his first book and the present, he is one of the most widely distributed authors in the Muslim world. In 2010, Oktar was selected as one of the top 50 of the 500 most influential Muslims in the world by the Royal Islamic Strategy Studies Center of Jordan. So he's doing a lot of things.
Good for him. Really making moves.
Yeah. He also has his own television show, which began broadcasting in 2011.
Who gave this man a voice?
I think he gave it to himself.
Well.
And okay. He has enough money to be, like, buying a bunch of people off.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
So he's very wealthy. He's very powerful. Blah, 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 blah. So now we can talk about his followers.
Okay.
His followers are mostly women who are, air quotes, empowered to find their own freedom.
Okay. It seems weird for feminists to follow a boy, but okay.
We'll get deeper into the feminist issue that we have here.
Okay.
So they run the television show I just mentioned that started broadcasting in 2011 called A9.
Okay.
They talk about everything from politics to Kim Kardashian.
Wow.
A9 is also a televangelist program where Oktar preaches conservative creationist views.
Okay.
And in between segments on religion politics, he likes to dance with his female followers. These dance sessions would be aired as part of the program.
Okay, I feel icky. What do you mean dance with them?
Literally not touch them, just like have eye fuckery with them.
What? Like gyrate?
Yes, but like not touching.
Ugh.
It's so weird. What? Because it's got to be aired on a conservative channel, like a conservative base.
Okay.
So they don't touch. They just like move to the music.
Okay.
Together. It's very weird.
I want to film what you're doing and post it online.
I look like a snake.
You do.
Okay. Oktar has, a name for his followers. He calls them his kittens.
No. No.
Yeah.
I'm out.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And that is how other people are to refer to them as
Absolutely
well.
Absolutely not. I will not.
I watched a Vice episode on YouTube, and it was so fascinating.
I love Vice.
Link it in the show notes. It's super fascinating. It was uploaded on November 20th. Happy birthday.
Thanks.
2015, although I believe it was filmed before that.
Okay.
The investigative reporter is a woman named Mahir Ahmed, and I believe she looks young. She's probably between 25 and 35.
Okay.
And she goes into the mansion where Oktar lives to interview him and his followers.
Okay.
Before she was allowed to meet with the women, she was forced to wear makeup, and she's not one that wears makeup.
Okay.
They would not allow the makeup application process to be filmed.
What?
Right. And this poor girl, like, goes in. She's already pretty uncomfortable because they have lied about a bunch of stuff.
Oh.
About, like, what they're allowed to film. Because they get there, and they're like, oh, yeah, no cameras. And she's like, no, I've already gotten the approval for all of this.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you can film, but, like, we film it, and then we edit it, and then we send it to you.
Oh, no. That's different.
That's not the same.
That's different.
So any interview that she does, she's doing on her personal cell phone camera in a bathroom, because that's the only place she's not watched, or waiting in their car.
Oh, my God. What?
Yeah. So she is forced to put on makeup before she can interview any of the women.
Ugh.
She comes out from behind this curtain, and she has on pastel pink lipstick.
Ooh.
That is, like, iridescent and nearly purple.
Oh, God.
The most eyeshadow. And she's just like, heh, I hate it.
Thinks I hate it.
Right. She said that it felt like somebody just rubbed crayon all over her.
Okay.
They take her around and they show her this super luxe life. Like, they give her the entire rigmarole of their compound, their mansion. It's got pools, hot tubs, multiple living areas, a crap ton of bedrooms. And everything is, like, decked out in all of the elegance you could imagine.
Yeah.
And she even says, I got super distracted by all of this. I forgot who I was talking to.
By, like, the opulence?
Yes.
Oh, God.
And she describes it as being, like, on MTV Cribs.
Okay.
She walks out into the pool area where they have, I have written down, like, 5 or 6 museum-esque displays, but they're, like, glass, plastic towers that are about hip height, so you can see what's in them.
Like, people would use to, like, display, like, a bust on?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. But they're all, like, encased in plastic.
Okay.
And each of these displays has a fossil in it, and fossil is in air quotes here.
Oh, God.
And a photo of that animal fossil now.
Okay.
And the example on this episode is a seahorse in a seahorse fossil that they claim is 5 million years old. And it's their idea of saying, like, see this 5 million-year-old seahorse fossil? See how evolution is bullshit? Like, this is the same seahorse that's been around for 5 million years. Evolution didn't happen.
Oh, well, yeah, I would say that that's probably an illogical fallacy, but sure.
But, like, okay.
No, okay.
Oktar wrote huge books called The Alist of Creation, which had many volumes, and he sent these books unrequested to universities all over the world. Like, he sent them to Yale, Harvard.
Oh, my God.
All of the really prestigious universities in Europe, in Turkey, everywhere got one of these books.
These are not the type of universities who are going to help, like,
a cult leader.
It's not going to bolster your claim.
No.
Like, let's send it to, like, Bethel or those based in, like, traditionally more conservative views.
Right.
To gain traction.
Yeah. Those that already believe in creationism. Like,
yes.
That, like, believe that that's how the world was created.
Like, you will, like, enhance their agenda.
Yes.
By providing all of this word vomit about evolution.
Right. And so these books, and they gift one of these to this investigative reporter.
Oh, no.
This girl, like, pulls it up next to her. It is, like, a 15-pound book.
What?
It is giant. And there's multiple volumes. There's, like, 1 through 6.
Oh, my God.
It's bananas.
I don't have enough I don't have enough time or willpower in the world.
Right. In the logical world, many scientists have just torn it apart. You can find screenshots on screenshots on screenshots about scientists tearing this book apart.
Love that for scientists.
Right. So it's just like that's a lot of paper.
Well,
that should probably just be recycled floating around there. So during the interview with this investigative reporter from Vice, Oktar says that the women should not be equal to man, but more important than man. He says that as a child, he would kiss his mother's feet and smell heaven. Nasty.
Stop having people mess around with your feet. Stop allowing.
I would go so far as to say if there's feet in a religious ceremony or like religious context of any kind, it's probably a cult.
Well, you're gonna piss off a lot of Christians.
Yeah, I know, because I did foot washing ceremonies.
What? At
Camp Mac.
What?
Girl, I've never told you this.
You had to wash somebody's feet?
Okay, I have to put down my tablet.
Oh.
Okay, so camp went from Sunday to Sunday.
No.
On Saturday evening, when they've broken your will as a human, sure, and make you think that you're broken.
Yeah.
They make you believe you've been healed by the Savior of Christ.
Oh.
And they take you to the beach, because we're on a lake.
Uh-huh.
And the lake has a really long pier. And the camp counselors start out, and they pick people from the audience to wash their feet.
What?
And then they hold your hand, and you're all dressed in white, and they take you
to camp? Unrealistic.
Not gonna happen.
What even kind of laundry facilities do they have?
Right. Well, the camp counselors are all dressed in white. Like, us as campers were dressed in, like, we had shorts on.
Sure.
So they, like, take your hand, and they, like, walk, and it's completely silent, like, zero talking, and everybody's crying. And they take you to the pier, and they have you sit down. Then the camp counselors, like, get in the water, and they wash your feet. And then you, once you get your feet washed, you have to walk down the pier, and then you pick somebody else, and you take them to the pier to get to wash their feet.
What?
I'm not kidding.
I need you to bring this up in therapy, because this is the most unsettling, weirdly overtly sexual, but like very understated kind of like child emotional manipulation.
For somebody who's like 30, I have nearly crossed paths with a cult 3 times in my life. That's too many.
It's about once a decade.
It's too many.
Not great odds.
I kid you not. And I mean, there's probably like, I don't know, maybe 80 campers.
Has
and
this
like,
camp been shut down by the feds or?
Fuck no.
You can still like.
You can still go.
You can send your kids.
Yeah. Uh huh.
No.
Yeah.
Is this an Indiana group thing or? Is
yeah.
This
is like an hour and a half north of us.
What?
Yeah.
I hate this so much.
Camp Alexander Mack.
Who is that?
So if you get real deep into the Brethren, like, faith.
Oh, God.
Alexander Mack is the person that founded the Brethren faith. And if you get a little too far into it, where we went to, like, the youth camp, the national one.
Oh, my God.
The first time I ever flew on a plane, I went to the National Youth Camp Conference.
Oh, my God.
And my youth group ended up piecing out early because it was too radical for us. What? For us foot washers. Because
y'all washed your feet in a dang old crick and you were like, I'm out.
Yes, because they were like, Alexander Mack is equal to Jesus.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Yeah, so like my group was like, no, bro. And then my best friend and I roomed together and they told us that I was going to hell because I believed that war was like part of our history and sometimes necessary in order for the greater good.
What?
That there was like classes we had to take every day. We had to take up like 3 classes every day. And one of them was about like tattoos and piercings and how like your body is a temple. And I was like, but I'm like going to get a tattoo. And they were like,
you're going to,
but you will go to hell. And I was like, doubt that. I'm going to get a tattoo.
I will never understand why people put so much time and effort. And what is the purpose?
Oh, Allie and I, by day 2, We were like, no. So we stayed in our dorm. They had it at the campus.
Okay.
In Denver, like the Denver.
Is this that cult college that you wanted to go to?
No, that was a different cult college.
Oh, for fuck's sake, Taylor.
That was different.
We are about to spiral down so many different cult segues here.
I know. But day two, Allie and I were like, no, absolutely not. So we decided we were going to stay in our dorm.
Okay.
And we were going to paint our toenails and like watch the shitty TV.
Uh-huh.
And.
Did they come get you?
They tried. So they were like, we'll check and see if you go to all of these classes. And I was like, okay, how are you going to keep track of like 4,000 teenagers? Good friggin' luck. Most of you are out trying to get weed in Denver. Like,
no shit.
Okay. So Allie and I were like, we're going to roll up a towel and put it underneath our door so that at least they'll think that the lights are off. And they stood and knocked at our door for like 5 minutes. Like, we know you're in there. We know that you didn't go to a class. Just come out now. You're not in trouble. And Allie and I were like,
and
we
out.
Just were completely silent until they went away.
And they did?
And they did, eventually.
Okay.
But, oh, it was...
I love your commitment to sneakery.
At this point, I was more afraid of what was going to happen if I went to the door. Because I had been treated so poorly the day before.
Oh.
About, like, my dad was a history teacher. I do believe that history repeats itself, and I was just raised with, like, war is an inevitability, I think
you mean logic. You're raised with logic and yes. critical thinking skills.
Right. And, like, my dad pulled me out of church services before during things that were happening that he didn't believe were true. So, like, I was very, like, aware of the fact that you could disagree with what was happening in church and still believe in some kind of a higher power.
Yes.
And so to be pulled out of a room where I was like, okay, like I'm going to get a tattoo. I'm not going to hell. I believe that history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. I'm still not going to hell. And y'all can't get fucked. Ridiculous. So ridiculous. Okay.
I love that.
So that's my story about feet washing. I'm so sorry. That was quite the tangent.
It was important to have. It was a good conversation that we needed to have on this podcast.
You believe in feet washing?
Cool.
Okay.
I can't. I don't like washing my own feet.
Like, it's a quick shower. Like, bleh, bleh, bleh.
Yeah. Like, get on out. Get in, get out.
Yeah. I have to, like, pump myself up to go get, like, a pedicure.
It makes me uncomfortable, too, to get a pedicure. I feel like it's a imbalance of, like, human whatever.
Yeah. No,
I'll bring it up in therapy. I don't know.
Yeah. We have a whole list.
Yeah.
Okay, so Oktar talks about how women should not only be CEOs, but also be paid more than men. So the rhetoric
hold on, wait, I'm back on board.
Yeah, the rhetoric is very confusing because I'm like, yeah, bro, like, that's right.
Sure.
100%.
Okay. That's not
the
reality.
No, this is not what's happening.
Okay.
He also believes that women should wear whatever they want, whatever that makes them feel free, with the exception that their sexual parts should be covered. So
for breasts, like hygienic purposes or for
modesty.
Okay.
So he would be totally cool with you wearing a bikini. Like, as long as your nipples, your vagina, and your butt
you
are covered.
Nipples. You have to say nip nops.
Your nip naps need to be covered.
Cover them dang old nip nops.
But yeah, he'd be totally cool with you wearing a bikini. That's, like, kind of the line
pasties
in the sand.
Pasties in a G-string.
Whatever.
Okay.
He says that women are perceived as being dangerous in Islamic culture and that instead of being feared, that they should be protected.
No, you should fear us.
Yeah, I like it. While he forces them to wear incredibly flashy dresses, level 10 makeup, and get plastic surgery, and
what?
Bleach their hair blonde.
No.
Yes. And he encourages them to work out incessantly.
Mm. What?
Yeah.
Why?
Because
we're sounding a little control-y.
Yeah.
For a
man who wants women to feel empowered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like
not
you're
good.
Just like slapping a mask on
misogyny.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the same shit with a pretty new exterior.
Yep. That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
So I want you to picture the Playboy Mansion.
Ugh, if I must.
That's what this is, only make it have more like one more level of everything to make it just a little bit uncomfortable, like a little bit more uncomfortable. Like make the boobs bigger, they went to a bad plastic surgeon. Let me put it that way. Like, okay. Bad plastic surgery. And I'm here to, like, say that I want you to be empowered to look however you want to look. If you want to go get your lips done, by all means, go get your lips done.
Plastic surgery for,
like,
you.
I want you to pay for what you deserve. So, mm-hmm. like, don't take your first offer. You know.
My mom would say never skimp on your doctor, your lawyer, or your shoes.
Agree. So, the problem becomes when a man tells you what you have to be, and none of these women chose that. So I just want to be super clear about, like, I'm not judging these women for what they looked like.
It is fine when you choose that for yourself.
Right, but they didn't choose that for themselves.
A man pushed that upon them.
Yes.
Got it.
And I just didn't want anybody to be like, they hate women.
Yeah. We love women.
Which would be, like, the absolute falsehood of the century. The kitten that acted as a translator for the investigative reporter was a woman named Ceylan Özgül. She was interviewed by a British reporter. And as much as I want to pronounce her name right, it sounded like he was saying Jaylen.
Okay.
But it's spelled C-E-Y-L-A-N.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with Ceylan in my terrible American accent just because I don't want to be super wrong by trying to impersonate a British person saying this woman's name.
Yeah.
So when Meher asks, Ceylan only has good things to say about how much her life has changed since she joined Oaktar, but she doesn't really say anything about, like, what her life was like before. She just says how much better it is.
Okay.
And then she does another interview in 2018 and talks about her first failed escape attempt in 2013 after she realized she was in a cult.
Ah.
She didn't get very far before they pulled her back.
I can't imagine.
The women are expected to talk about how amazing and free they are so that other women will join them. So their recruitment is televised.
Oh, no.
Yeah. In the Vice episode, the investigator describes it would be, she thought it would be a really fun and, like, bubbly experience. Like, in her head, she was, like, going to hang out by the pool with all of these really empowered women and talk about how their lives have changed and yada, yada, yada.
No.
And she said it just felt like walking onto a set of a reality show and finding out it's really a prison.
Oh.
Yeah, she was so uncomfortable.
Oh.
It's all glitz and glam and maybe a little bit of an odd spectacle until we look behind the curtain.
Yeah, well.
So, in July of 2018, Oktar and 166 of his associates were arrested after a Turkey media watchdog imposed fines on the A9 channel and suspended the broadcast, saying it violated women's rights and gender equality.
Fucking love that for Turkey.
I know!
Love that.
During the raid, police found weapons, ammunition, and almost 70,000 birth control pills.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, what? That is so many.
When asked, Oktar said the pills were for his kittens when they had skin problems or menstrual irregularities.
Get out of my face.
That's a lie.
Are we selling them? Are we confiscating them? What are we? Black market?
He made them take contraceptives because he was raping them.
No. Oh my God.
Remember how I said it was going to escalate very quickly?
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Okay.
He was hit with huge series of charges, including fraud, running a criminal organization, espionage, tax offenses, sexual assault, rape, child crimes, etc. The indictment paints a picture of a man who is a leader of a criminal gang that feeds off of blackmail, extortion, and money laundering. Members of Oktar's following started speaking out about the treatment they received while they were with Oktar. Ceylan, the woman from just a minute ago, was interviewed and said that every single thing on the charges listed was true. The only thing she did not witness was her own eyes was the abuse of children, but there were enough rumors for her to assume the validity of that statement.
Oh, God.
One of the women that testified against him at the trial said that Oktar repeatedly sexually abused her and other women. Prosecutors said the organization used its good-looking members to deceive young women. Those members raped or sexually abused women and were blackmailed first by members pretending that their affairs were recorded on video. They were also brainwashed under the pretext of religious teachings. On Monday, January 11th, 2021, the court gave Oktar a total of 1,075 years in prison on charges of founding and leading a criminal organization, political or military espionage, aiding the Gulenist terrorist group, sexual abuse of minors, sexual abuse, deprivation of liberty of a person, torture, disturbance of a right to education, recording personal data, and making threats.
Send his ass to jail. Send his stupid ass to jail.
He's gone.
Good.
In his final defense statement, Oktar rejects the charges against him and said that he has close to 1,000 girlfriends.
Listen, you can reject it all you want.
You're still going to spend 1,000 years in jail.
Yep. Yeah. So, that is the very unsettling cult of the Valley of the Islamic Dolls.
That ramped up so quickly and then came to a screeching halt.
Yep, that's all I got for you.
I love it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Damn!
Woo! Yeah, I found them yesterday and I was like, dear God. Dear God.
Let me just write up an expose real quick about these.
Like, crack my knuckles. Like, hope I love staying up till midnight.
Oh my God. Ooh, that was a wild tale.
That's all we do here.
Thanks
for that.
You're welcome.
What's up, guys? I'm Maddie.
And I'm Sammy, and we are the hosts of Girl in the Gov, the podcast. So you might be thinking, what is Girl in the Gov, the podcast? We are a podcast where we are rebranding politics. We are making it approachable, accessible, and easy to understand through super informative interviews with experts.
We know what you're thinking. Politics is taboo, it's boring, it's confusing, and it's divisive. We are changing the game and making it fun and easy to understand, especially with our I Have a Stupid Question segment, where we have our amazing expert guests answer all of our stupid questions so you don't have to.
And don't worry, we have stupid questions too, so we're learning right then and there with you. Of course, we want you guys to be able to participate in the podcast and share all of your stupid questions as well. So please hit us up at Girl in the Gov, the podcast on Instagram, Girl in the Gov 1 on Twitter, and Girl in the Gov on TikTok. We want to make sure that we are able to cover all of your questions. There is no question too stupid, so please let us know. And for the most important part, Maddie, where can people listen to Girl in the Gov, the podcast?
So you can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. That's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, all the places. So subscribe, rate, review, and tune in every Wednesday and let us know what you think.
I am ready to tell you another wild tale, and I am going to give, like, I don't want to say, like, a disclaimer, but the research for this is different than anything else I've ever done because this is not my research.
Okay.
This is an article that was written on Cult Nation by Mark Lasky, and it is the most in-depth, comprehensive, well-researched article I have ever had the pleasure of reading in all of our, like, delving into investigative journalism.
Okay.
There is no way for me to do a better job to talk about this than what he said.
Okay.
So
we're just going to read the article.
So this is, buckle up.
Okay.
Okay.
I am buckled up, seatbelt engaged, ready to go.
Whew. The new age.
Oh no.
The new age may have dawned in the 1960s, but it would never fully shine. For many, spiritual awakening would lead to something of an existential crisis as the harsh realities of the following decade began to encroach on their life.
Okay.
Some found refuge in communes, others turned to drugs or diet fads, and many would join the ranks of the New Religious Movement, a cluster of fringe Christian, Eastern mystic, neo-pagan, and various self-help groups that claimed to offer a path to self-discovery and higher purpose. The spirit of religious revival was in the air, but not everybody was celebrating. The inevitable backlash to these often strange and sometimes dangerous new religious sects led to the rise of the counter-cult movement. Not surprisingly, Christian fundamentalists would play a leading role. The shock propaganda of these counter-cultists successfully tapped into the social anxieties of the day and found broad support among concerned parents. With more women joining the workforce and increasing numbers of teenagers left to their own devices, there was a new level of fear and uncertainty within the nuclear family unit. The threat to one's children falling victim to some crazed cult seemed very real, or so the public was led to believe. From within the social context, a cultural phenomenon known as the Satanic Panic was born, fueled by religious fanatics, quack psychiatrists, and the tabloid media. It was claimed that a vast satanic criminal network existed throughout the country. Organized devil worshippers were responsible for any number of heinous acts, including kidnapping, child abuse, animal mutilation, rape, torture, human sacrifice, and, drumroll, cannibalism.
Oh my god.
Mm-hmm. All of which was taking place under our very noses.
Oh, sure. In suburbia.
Mm-hmm. So, by the late 1970s, the hope and promise of the prior decade seemed like a distant memory as the national landscape came to be defined by recession, unemployment, and rising crime rates. The once prosperous textile city of Fall River, Massachusetts, was hit particularly hard.
Massachusetts. Okay.
Is that not what I said?
No. Yeah, no. I'm just trying to picture, like, the satanic panic in Massachusetts.
It's hard to place.
With, like, it's beautiful white picket fences and beautiful trees.
Oh, but it's there. Factories closed, buildings were abandoned, and the downtown area had become a total wasteland.
Shut up. Really?
Yep. Leaving behind an economic void that provided fertile ground for a thriving trade in drugs and sex work.
Wait, why did everybody up and leave?
Because the recession in the 70s.
Oh, okay. I thought
it was like the industrial area giving way. It's okay. Like the same Detroit and Flint and blah, blah, blah.
Okay. I got it. I was like in my head, I was like, the devil is here. And everybody's like, ah!
Somebody dug a hole too deep and the devil came out.
Yeah. That's what I had in mind. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So like industrial collapse, everybody's left out. Now drugs have taken place.
Yeah. Cool. Drugs and sex work.
Cool.
Amidst this urban decay, I love their primer, a series of murders took place between October 1979 and February 1980.
That's quick.
Not a lot of months in there. Two young women, both local sex workers, had been bound, raped, tortured, and bludgeoned to death.
Oh, no.
A third victim's body would never be found beyond a skull fragment and clumps of hair left behind in a nearby forest.
That's it.
The investigation into the brutal killings resulted in a tabloid media frenzy, with headlines that seemed to confirm the most outlandish satanic panic fear-mongering. In the end, the Fall River cult murders became the most sensational criminal case to come out of the city since Lizzie Borden stood trial for butchering her family nearly a century earlier.
Holy shitballs. Did you know the Lizzie Borden Museum went up for sale for $2 million?
Oh, well, let's put a down payment on it.
Sold.
With all of her, sold for $250 in Chuck E. Cheese tickets.
Because that's all we have
to offer. That's all we got.
I have like a really good stack of like makeup palettes I could offer.
Used.
But still there.
But still. Gently used, well loved.
Yeah. That's all I have for trade.
I don't have a lot. I have nothing that anybody else wants.
You have a lot of rocks.
I do. I have, listen, if anybody wants crystals, I got hella rocks in my house. The body of the first victim was found on October 13th, 1979. Doreen Levesque, a 17-year-old runaway from New Bedford, was discovered behind the Diamond Vocational High School. Her wrists had been bound with fishing line, and there were signs of sexual torture. Mm. She had also been stabbed in the head several times and suffered multiple skull fractures. Police discovered that the young girl had been selling herself and initially suspected one of her clients of committing the murder. However, the county medical examiner determined that the killing was likely committed by multiple people, and the forensic evidence also suggested a ritual element to the crime, a possible death by stoning.
Oh my God. In the late 80s?
In the 70s.
Oh, yep. Okay.
79 to 80.
Yeah. Damn.
Whew. The trail of blood left behind would soon lead the investigation in a different, much darker direction. As it turned out, Fall River's criminal underworld was ruled by Satan at this time. Yes, Satan. Like the devil. Satan.
He did it.
Satan. If the witness accounts of various drug addicts and low-level criminals are to be believed, the local vice trade was controlled by a cult of devil worshippers who took their directives from the Prince of Darkness himself, who in turn was paid off in sacrificial blood and human souls.
Is this in a police report somewhere?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
A month after the discovery of Doreen Levesque's battered corpse, a man named Andy Maltius visited the Fall River Police Station. He was there to file a missing persons report for his girlfriend, a 22-year-old sex worker named Barbara Raposa, who, like Levesque, worked the Bedford Street area. Maltius told police that he feared for the woman's safety. He then mumbled something about a satanic cult and claimed to have information relating to the Levesque murder. With no other leads in the case, they arranged a formal interview to see what exactly this man knew. By all accounts, Andy was a mentally unstable creep. He was a pedophile, a sexual sadist, a violent rapist, and of a recent religious conversion, a devout Christian.
Andy Bud. Can you get it together?
He cannot. He cannot get it together.
Okay.
Quote, "Jesus Christ is my personal Lord and Savior," the 44-year-old New Bedford man told police as he held up a small Bible to prove his newfound faith. "Once I worshiped Satan, but now I worship Jesus."
Oh my God. Okay.
It was an odd way to begin an interview.
Yeah, I imagine that was probably a little bit startling.
I used to believe in Satan, but like now I like really love Jesus. Anyway, so what do you want to know?
So I got all the info. I got all the deets.
Uh-huh.
I played both sides here, friend.
I got
all the knowledge.
Tell me what you need. According to his statements, God. Andy and his girlfriend Barbara were practicing Satanists at the time of her disappearance.
No! All I could think of is like them and like, I know that this is the like 79, 80s, but like them in their like all their 40s regalia, like Andy and Barbara, like going down to the cave to worship the devil. Shut up.
Are you smoking the devil's lettuce? Like,
say? God damn. Okay.
It's the devil, see?
Barbara.
They were members of a local cult. Doreen Levesque was also involved with the group prior to her murder. He claimed to have no direct knowledge of the crime, but told police he believed the cult to be responsible. The story seemed far-fetched and was received with skepticism, but he was insistent. He offered to arrange a meeting with two other cult members who, he was sure, had more direct information relating to the case. A few days later, police were introduced to Karen Marsden and Robin Murphy.
Okay.
Karen was a 20-year-old single mother. Like many of her peers who worked Fall River's red light district, she was a runaway and a drug addict. Police accounts described her as nervous and emotional. Robin Murphy was the exact opposite. She was cold, she was deliberate, and she was calculated. The younger of the two, she was only 17 at the time, both a sex worker and an aspiring pimp. Murphy was a tough street kid who was described as possessing a high degree of intelligence, and a domineering personality.
Okay.
Which, like, if you took that energy and put it into something productive, could, like, be so successful.
Right. Congratulations. You've just won.
Great. The girls were open about their relationship as roommates and lovers. Their connection to Andy, however, was left vague. They knew him from around. According to later testimony, Murphy claimed that he had been molesting her since the age of 11.
Oh, no.
Throughout the interview, Murphy remained silent, studying the officers and occasionally scowling at her friend. Karen did all the talking. Rambling at various levels of coherency, she eventually broke down in tears and told police, "Carl Drew killed Doreen." Far from unknown to the local authorities, Carl Drew was a 26-year-old pimp with a violent reputation who ran his business out of the Bedford Street District. Originally from New Hampshire, he had been raised on a small farm. In later interviews, he would speak about a childhood marked by hard labor and physical abuse. One cruel coming-of-age story involved his alcoholic father tying a rope around the terrified boy's ankles and lowering him down a well to remove a cluster of dead rats. Drew eventually ran away from home at the young age of 14 and found his place among Fall River's criminal underground, keeping company with bikers, drug addicts, and sex workers. Carl Drew certainly fits the profile of someone who is capable of the type of savagery unleashed on Doreen. He also had a direct connection to the victim because he was her pimp. Unfortunately, there was nothing to link him to the murder beyond the unsubstantiated claim of a young drug addict. Marzin was pressed for more details and even offered witness protection for her cooperation, but she gave no further information. Only a final statement promising that if she were to turn up dead, it would be Drew who was responsible.
Ooh.
Detectives from the Fall River Major Crimes Division would remain in contact with Karen in the weeks that followed, hoping to learn more about the Fall River cult. As this motley group of pimp and sex work practitioners of the black arts came to be known. "I'm a good person," Marzin sobbed. "I believe in God." Fearing for her life, she referred to Carl Drew as the devil and told police of the consequences she expected for her betrayal.
Oh no.
In a narrative that mirrored the Manson family cult, she claimed that Drew organized his sex work ring as a satanic coven that he ruled with an iron fist. "Satan will take his toll," he would threaten the girls. For a more Christian fearful like Marzin, this meant not only a violent death. She also believed that her soul would be sacrificed and cast into the flaming pits of hell for eternity.
Hmm.
Accompanied by Carol Fletcher, another young area sex worker with ties to the cult, Marzin took police to the nearby Freetown State Forest. It was here that the girls claimed that the cult held their nocturnal gatherings. As they passed by an algae-covered pool of water, Marzin cowered in fear. This is where she was told that Carl Drew would dump her body.
Yikes.
After injecting battery acid into her veins
oh my God.
And offering her soul to Satan if she talked to the police.
Battery acid?
Yeah.
Ugh. Okay. I hate it.
It's a lot. It's a lot. When it came to threats of violence, the feared pimp seemed to excel in morbid creativity.
Okay.
Another girl who worked for Drew named Cookie, also known as Mildred Aww. Jukes. Cute, right?
Cookie.
Later told police of his planned retribution against a woman who had gotten her arrested for sex work.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was going to kill her for it, she claimed. Tie her to a tree to be sacrificed and pour warm blood from a live goat all over her face.
Goat carry on it.
Mm. Carl Drew. Satanist. Bad man. If the stories were to be believed, it would seem that the detectives had their murder suspect. However, as they got Karen Marzin talking more, they came to find out that Drew was not the only dangerous individual in her life. As it turned out, Robin Murphy, her teenage friend and lover, also had a dark side. A very dark side.
Uh-oh.
Even before her introduction to the Circle of Satanists based out of Bedford Street's red-like scene, the young girl had long been dabbling in the occult. She was also described by those around her as being psychologically unstable and prone to violence. Far from being an unwilling participant or minor player, the young girl would soon emerge as a, and possibly the, central figure involved in the Fall River cult murders.
Oh, shit. So it's this other girl.
Hmm. As the detectives were becoming familiar with this murky cast of characters associated with the Fall River cult, another body had been discovered. Okay. On January 26, 1980, the frozen and bloodied corpse of Barbara Raposa was found in the woods behind an abandoned printing factory.
Barbara! Wait, Barbie. This is the same Barbara?
Okay. Yep. Her wrists were tied together with fishing line. She had been sexually assaulted and her skull had been crushed with a rock. Another local sex worker and Satanist dabbler killed in, remarkably similar, cold blood. The Vless case had given police a glimpse into the strange and shadowy underworld that existed in their city. It also gave them a circle of potential suspects, some of whom were already under investigation, and it didn't take long to connect the dots. The first to be interviewed in connection with Raposa's murder was Andy, last known person to see her alive. A nervous Andy denied any knowledge of the crime. However, a few days later, he contacted police after receiving details of the murder in a psychic dream.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, friends. Nobody believes you.
Very specific details.
Oh, no.
Police played along and brought him to the crime scene, allowing him to describe what he had seen in his dream. It turns out that he was quite the clairvoyant, knowing exactly where the woman's body had been discovered.
Quite the clairvoyant.
Its positioning, time of death, method of killing, and various other details that were not yet made public at the time. His psychic testimony was indeed helpful to the investigation, although probably not in the way it was intended.
Yeah.
A confused Andy soon found himself in handcuffs and charged with murder.
But I'm a psychic.
Oh, but it was a dream. In the days following his arrest, the investigation received further assistance from an unexpected source. Robin Murphy contacted police and offered to testify against Andy as a witness to the murder. She also claimed to have been present for the killing of Doreen and agreed to turn state's evidence in that case as well. In exchange for her cooperation, she brokered a deal where she was placed in protective custody and granted immunity in both murders. A very shrewd girl.
Yep, she listened to us. Don't shut up.
You can shut the F up.
Shut up. Come up with a deal.
I don't love it for murderers.
Nope.
But I do love it for people who are, like, being held against their will for, like, crimes that they didn't really commit.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. The story she gave police and later repeated in court was that Andy had killed Barbara after discovering that she had been cheating on him with another man. Murphy claimed to have been with them both on the night of the murder. They had all been partying together while driving around the city, and at some point the couple started arguing. Andy then parked his car behind the abandoned factory, dragged Barbara out, and raped her. She cried for help, and he proceeded to beat her, first with his fist and then with a rock.
Oh my God.
Afterwards, he drove off with Murphy, leaving his bloodied girlfriend to crawl away on her own. So why didn't Murphy go to police sooner? She claimed that Andy had threatened her with the same fate if she talked. It was only after he was behind bars that she felt safe enough to come forward with her story. It was a testimony full of holes, but given his past history of violent sexual transgressions, it would be enough to put Andy away for the rest of his life. With rumors of Satanism and human sacrifice in the air, the more mundane jealous rage motive came as something of a media disappointment.
What?
Barely even worthy of a front page headline.
Oh no!
What about Carl Drew and his cult of murderous black-robed followers?
Yeah, what about him?
Those details would come to light during Murphy's recounting of the Doreen murder. After forensic evidence was near identical to the Raposa case, according to Murphy, there was no direct connection between the two murders, except for the fact that she happened to be present for both. The killing of Doreen was an offering of the soul to Satan, she would tell police. And as expected, Carl Drew was behind it. Murphy claimed that the teenage sex worker had recently left Drew's coven with the intention of working the streets on her own. Unfortunately, leaving the group wasn't so easy. Satan had a toll that needed to be paid. Aiming to collect, Drew tracked down his former employee at a Bedford Street bar and forced her into his car. Robin, Karen, and a man named Willie Smith, who was Drew's friend and a fellow Satanist, came along for the ride. Drew threatened Levesque, telling her that she couldn't afford to work the streets alone, and backhanded her across the face. They pulled behind the high school, and the two men took the girl under some bleachers out of sight. Murphy and Marzen stayed in the car. According to her initial statement, Murphy heard no screams and claimed to see nothing. After a while, the men returned without Levesque, and the four of them drove away. When asked what happened to her, Drew replied, "You don't want to know." Murphy's version of events may have been plausible if Doreen had been, say, quietly smothered or strangled to death, but the testimony didn't match up with the forensic evidence left behind, which painted an extremely violent picture of sexual assault, prolonged torture, and a very bloody death.
Yikes.
It's hard to believe that she heard no screams and saw no evidence of blood on either man. Also, according to her, the whole ordeal was over in a matter of minutes. In fact, she told police that she wasn't even certain that she had been murdered until she saw it in the newspapers a few days later. In time, her story evolved to include various gory details and satanic embellishments, all of which had apparently slipped her mind during the initial interview.
Oh, did it?
Did it slip your mind?
Just like I forgot.
I had a lot going on that day.
My calendar was boxed.
Robin wasn't the only Cole member talking to police at this time. Since her initial interview, Karen continued to stay in touch with detectives working the case. It's generally believed that she was present for both murders, though her recollections would sharply contrast with Murphy's versions of events. While she maintained that Carl was the cult figurehead behind these killings, she pointed to Murphy as also playing a direct leading role. In particular, according to Marsden, she had instructed all of those present to take part in the mutilation of Barbara and Levesque's bodies, possibly for ritual purposes, but more likely to keep their silence by directly involving them in the crime. Unfortunately, Karen was considered an unreliable witness due to her drug use, erratic behavior, and unwillingness to testify in court. Her statements were basically treated as gossip by police, not to say that they doubted her claims, only they were unable to do much with them in the court of law. She also seemed to get worse with each meeting, and by the time her final interview, she was on the verge of an emotional breakdown, convinced that she was going to be the next murderer. In the end, this paranoia would be well-founded. She was reported missing on February 9th, 1980.
Oh, she knew!
Mm-hmm. 2 months later, a grisly discovery was made in the nearby beach town of Westport. While clearing a parcel of land near Devil Pond, a man stumbled across the top half of a human skull. Police arrived on the scene and conducted a more detailed search of the area. They turned up the decaying carcass of 3 cats, sheep bones, and clumps of human hair.
Oh, God. Leave the cats alone.
Mm. Also sheep. Where do you even get sheep bones? I like from a sheep, but like...
like, where do you get sheep?
Where do you buy a sheep?
Any farm.
I feel like sheep should be plural and that shoop is like the singular.
Did you know a new Mandela effect? I guess it's not new, but what's the plural of octopus?
Octopi?
No.
What?
It's octopuses.
No, it's not.
It is.
What?
Yeah.
Octopussois?
It's octopuses.
No, it's not. I feel like I've been taught that from such a young age that it's octopi. Like cacti.
It's not.
I hate it. I hate it so much. I miss the old timeline.
Bring us back.
Okay. Forensics determined that the skull belonged to Karen. Soon after, a woman named Marine Sunny Sparta, mm-hmm. She had a little nickname, contacted police and named Robin as Karen's killer. The intercult killings had gone too far. Sunny was a former sex worker who lived in the Harbor Terrace housing projects near Fall River's waterfront. She hosted a number of satanic gatherings in her apartment and acted as something of a den mother figure to the young sex workers, runaways, and drug users who hung out there.
Mm-hmm.
She was also Murphy's ex-lover. According to her, Robin had admitted to the murder during a phone conversation. Carol Fletcher, who accompanied Marsden when she took police on a tour of the Freetown State Forest a few months earlier, also came forward with information. She claimed that Robin Murphy and Carl Drew were responsible for the murder. Drew's friend, Carl Davis, a pimp who operated out of both Fall River and nearby Providence, Rhode Island, was also present. A tangled freaking web we have woven here.
I can't keep up. There's so many names right
There's
now.
So many names, and the majority of them are dead.
Yeah, everybody murdered each other.
Yes. Fletcher herself had driven the group out to the secluded wooded area where the satanic sacrifice took place. As part of witness protection agreement, Robin was relocated to Dallas, where she was staying with a friend until Andy went to trial.
Wait, we know where she went, even though she was in witness protection?
The police knew. They're the ones who put her in witness protection.
And they were like, she's in Dallas.
She's in Dallas. That's a long way from Massachusetts.
Yes, it is. And Dallas is very big. But I feel like they shouldn't be, like, advertising that.
Well, following the accusations that connected her to Karen's murder, a warrant was issued for her arrest, and she was immediately brought back to Fall River. Carl Drew and Carl Davis were also indicted and placed under arrest. They weren't hard to track down as both of them were serving short sentences in county jail on unrelated assault charges.
Great.
During the interrogation, Robin broke down and told police, quote unquote, everything. In truth, it is a story that would continually evolve throughout the trial and be recanted during parole hearings years later, but Karen had become too much of a liability. She was a witness to the killing of Doreen and rumored to have gone to the police. Carl Drew decided her fate with the help of Carl Davis. He forced Murphy to take part in the murder as an act of loyalty to the cult. According to her statements, Murphy was made to drag Marsden from the car and pull out her hair. This is followed by a ritual stoning by Drew, Murphy, Fletcher, and Davis. Drew then cut off one of Marsden's fingers to make her feel pain and broke her neck with his bare hands.
Oh my God.
Well, in a trance-like state and under the direction of Drew, Murphy followed up by slitting her throat with a knife that was handed to her by Davis. The two men then tore the girl's head off and kicked it around the woods.
Tore it?
Tore it off.
Off? How? Oh God. Okay. I mean, in my head, that only makes sense if you're like, a Colin family member? Mm.
To, like, have the strength?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
They slit her throat. So, like, they... Yeah. I'm not trying to dig into that.
Oh, my God.
The frenzied post-mortem defilement would reach its climax as homage was paid to Satan. Drew carved an X into Marsden's torso and began to speak in tongues, offering her soul to the Dark Lord. He then dipped his thumb in her blood and made an X on Murphy's forehead. To break one final moral taboo, Murphy was made to perform oral sex on the headless cadaver before it was dumped in the woods, doused in gasoline, and burned to ashes.
Oh.
Let's take a deep breath.
Okay.
Okay. The more bizarre claims made during the Fall River cult murder investigations, like much of the evidence associated with cult-related cases during the Satanic Panic, are likely works of fiction. Many of the facts are, in fact, based on the word of a mentally unstable young woman who was known to manipulate those around her. It also eventually came to light that a fair bit of witness tampering, manipulation, and misconduct took place throughout the investigation by police.
Weird how that happens.
Including detectives who may have helped frame the case based on their own strongly held Catholic beliefs.
Oh no.
However, the fact remains that three women, all connected through their occupations and extracurricular occult activities, were brutally murdered under similar circumstances. It's tempting to dismiss the cult as nothing more than a tool of fear used to control Fall River's young and impressionable sex workers, but it appears that, at least in some form, a satanic grouping existed in the area at this time, and most of the people connected to the case had ties to it, some by their own admission. It's unlikely that all of them had imagined what they had seen or taken part in. In fact, two detectives from Fall River's Major Crimes Division even managed to witness one of the group's black masses held in Sunny Sparta's apartment firsthand as part of their investigation. Quote,
"Oh, okay.
We pray to Satan. We chant. We try to conjure him," she explained. In attendance that night were Carl Drew, Robin Murphy, Sparta, and a few other Bedford Street regulars. Assembled under a large mural of the devil painted on the living room wall.
Of an apartment!
Your landlord's gonna be pissed!
And have a lot of questions.
Congress, I'm not changing the furnace filter in there. I don't care who asks. Not doing it.
Your work order has been denied.
Assembled under a large mural of the devil painted on the living room wall, congregants formed a circle and started to chant, "Hail Satan, Hail Satan."
Oh no.
Leading the ceremony was a woman later identified as a sex worker from Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Although this particular meeting ended in anticlimax, Sparta described the more lively black mass gatherings took place in the Freetown State Forest. She denied any knowledge of human sacrifice, but admitted that goats or stray cats were occasionally used during ceremonies. The warm blood would be used in mock baptisms and poured over the heads of the gathered congregants. During the course of these rituals, it's claimed that participants lost consciousness or spoke in tongues. Quote, "Satan appears in a form where we feel his presence or he takes possession of one of us. You can tell when Satan is there. Some people even let him speak through them in his own language. It is in human speech. There's no way anyone on earth could fake it." In a later court testimony, Robin Murphy made similar claims. In addition to the chanting and incomprehensible speech, she noted the use of a skull and a substance she believed to be human blood used during ceremonies. She claimed to have attended 10 such cult gatherings between October 1979 and February 1980. The beliefs of the cult could best be described as a crude form of theistic Satanism, that is, literal devil worship.
Mm-hmm.
I worship Satan, Carl Drew would tell police under interrogation. I worship him like you worship God. Satan was not treated as some philosophical archetype or metaphor. He was the theistic embodiment of pure evil cast in the Christian tradition. For people like Drew, there is power in evil, a power that could be harnessed through satanic devotion and used to control the city's vice trade. As Burton Wolfe wrote in his introduction to Anton LaVey's The Satanic Bible, Satanism is based on the belief that human beings are inherently selfish, violent creatures, that life is a Darwinian struggle for survival of the fittest, that only the strong survive and the earth will be ruled by those who fight to win the ceaseless competition that exists in all jungles, including those of urbanized society.
Wow.
And that is the heinous story of the Fall River Cult.
My God. And that was the start of the Satanic Panic.
That was kind of on the tail end.
Oh,
this
okay.
is like Son of Sam kind of like era.
Okay. All right. What? Thanks. I hate it.
Thanks. I hate it. It does really like beg an interesting question about like how many people during this. Son of Sam is an excellent example of people who like claimed satanic
mm-hmm.
worship or like devil worship as
reason for their
crimes. Yeah. And for just because it was sensationalized.
Right. Woof.
Woof indeed.
Good job.
Thank you. Well, I didn't do anything. I just read an article.
That's true. Good job to Mark.
Mark.
Right?
The right. And I was enthralled.
That was an excellently written article.
Amazing. There was no way. I was so fascinated by it, but there was no way that I could do any kind of job.
It would
job.
Just be pulling excerpts from that article.
Literally. There was not any other comprehensive resource for this. So,
thank you to Mark. Our third podcaster of the day.
Love you so much. Appreciate you letting me borrow your article.
Oh my gosh.
You did a great job.
Do you have a bright and shiny for today?
Oh no. Sorry. I was like, I'm in like the Satan headspace. Hold on. Let me like.
We'll do a wiggle.
Let me like do a wiggle and get out of here. I am. I gotta get out.
Gotta get out of my mind.
I gotta. I'm very excited for, I don't know.
I have one.
Okay, you go first.
I'll go.
Okay.
You made me cookies today.
I did.
It was very nice. And they were delicious. They had a lot of chocolatey and like, did I get a butterscotch chip?
They are butterscotch pudding chocolate chip cookies.
Yep, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm.
It is the best cookie recipe I have ever found. I will post the recipe on Instagram with yes. this episode.
Yeah, it was delicious. So I filled up on cookies today. That's my bright shiny.
I love that. Oh, mine is I have a really yummy pasta dish planned this week.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, with some, like, pea shoots and...
Ooh.
It's going to be good stuff. Sun-dried tomatoes and, like, some other seasonable veggies. And
that sounds delicious.
Whatever. A pasta dish. I'm, like, very excited about it.
Welcome to our 30s. We're excited about pasta.
To be fair, when I was 20, I would have also gotten excited about pasta.
That's true.
I just wouldn't have been making it.
Very true. I would have been going to the Olive Garden.
There you go. Love that so much.
So, thank you for joining us.
That was a heavy episode. Follow us on the freaking social meds.
You know where to find us.
Love you. Send us emails if you want.
Yeah, do the things. Follow us, rate us. We love it when you do that. We love it when you talk to us. So do that too.
Be kind to yourself.
And to each other.
Goodbye.